Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast, where this week we'll be focusing on what happens now for the Tories. Who are the DUP? What do they want? And has the reshuffle shored up Theresa May's authority? Let's have the Schadenfreude section first, shall we, Stephen? How are things going for Theresa May?
Pretty badly, actually. Sorry.
You basically started laughing on Sky News yesterday, right, when you found out that Michael Gove had gone back into the cabin.
It was when I was asked the question, did you expect this and why has she done it? Because, of course, the answer is, well, yes, of course. Assuming, and she will manage to do some kind of deal with the unionist party, so not in the DUP, but Sylvia Herman, usually anti-conservative, but for obvious historical reasons, not a fan of the current Labour leadership.
I love that Lady Sylvia Herman is basically a party by herself at this point. She's become a kind of... I have to say, she's not one of the characters in this drama that I know a great deal about, but she's suddenly become incredibly important.
Well, she basically split off from the DUP when they did a deal with the Conservatives, because she's not a Conservative. But that was in an era when the Labour Party was led by people who had spent a lot of time working with unionists for a long period of time, which is obviously not really the case anymore.
So the cabinet reshuffle, or kind of no shuffle, as it turned out to be, there are a couple of appointments. Funny to demote Andrea Leadsom, essentially, to not full cabinet status leader of the House, but that is putting a job that requires a large amount of competence in the hands of somebody who has not demonstrated a surplus of it so far. And also the cuss of putting Michael Gove in DEFRA, when actually, really tragically, he was doing a good job at justice. Like, this is the thing, is that actually everybody in the prison sector thought having somebody with his credentials mean that we might actually, some of this reform prison stuff might get through. And the reform prison agenda has gone completely tits up.
There are a couple of interesting things. I mean, one, when you don't have a majority, right, and she basically will end up with a majority of two.
She really needs to hope that no one dies.
But, I mean, this is going to sound like a class war point, but Tories don't.
I know,
on the whole,
thing about
when you look at, like, a list of by-elections, right, like, Labour people who've, like, worked
down a mine,
yeah, or, you know, like, have set up, like, small businesses or whatever, on the whole, Conservative MPs tend to quit earlier and they tend to have led more comfortable lives, so they tend not to die. I know some of our right-wing leaders are going to accuse me of bias, but no, seriously, look at the list of by-elections and what caused them, right? There is a really, really clear pattern. So the risk of wastage is a lot.
God, that was
a really bad euphemism.
I don't
know why I thought that would be better than just people dying.
But you're right, because it also does include people resigning for general in health, people resigning because they've got a nice job somewhere else, people resigning because they've, you know, been found out they're having sex with their dog, any of that kind of stuff.
There's a big difference between a majority on confidence issues, particularly because the Fixed Term Parliament Act has drastically limited what brings down a government to basically the budget in the Queen's Speech. Basically, to misquote the popular song, the DUP may hold them up, but they're going to let them down an awful lot.
That's a song I don't know.
Don't hold me up or let me down.
I love your naive belief that you singing it was going to help me. If it was released after 1997, then I can't help it.
But anyway, the DUP will hold them up, but let them down a great deal. There's also the other problem. Oh, this is going to be so much fun. Then it's not just about, you know, passing bills. It's about controlling the legislative timetable, right? So let's say you have a vote on, let's say, I don't know, grammar schools. schools, right? And you want to pass grammar schools. Well, how long are you going to debate grammar schools? If you're going to debate it for 3 years, I mean, that's an exaggeration, then obviously you're not really going to... Yeah, if each reading takes a massive amount of time. But they don't have a majority on the timetable, right? Labour will, of course, disrupt everything they do.
Well, that's what I thought. So Yvette Cooper was on television at the weekend going, oh, we're going to have a grand commission, a cross-party commission for Brexit. And I thought, are you on glue? Because what it was the advantage to Labour to help, you know, something which will inevitably be incredibly divisive, right? I just don't know what's in it for Labour. Maybe, am I misjudging that? Is it actually, is a grand commission a really brilliant idea and there's something I haven't seen?
It sort of depends on whether or not you think... The numbers are... No, it's not.
Because I guess you could formally say you'd be part of a Grand Commission to seem kind of cool and bipartisan, but the idea of actually spending your political capital trying to pass unpopular bits of Brexit, I just think seems mad.
But it is kind of part of that kind of Yvette Cooper generation problem. And you know how at the beginning of Ed Zero, they just were like, oh, they kept setting up their own inquiries. And it's like, no one cares when the opposition has an inquiry. And they kept calling for judge-led inquiries. And it's like, guys, you haven't... It wasn't a nightmare. You're not the government anymore. Stop doing this. And it feels like exactly that, right? One, Theresa May's not going to do it. Two, so the prize is for a softer landing that allows you to kind of end up in the single market, or to be honest, I think more likely in the ECJ, spending a lot of money slightly overpaying for the schemes like policing that we want to keep in order to end up with a kind of Norway style arrangement, but with border control instead of fish, which actually for a high price and for subservience to the ECJ, that deal, which would not nuke the economy, would command a great deal of popular support, is very much on the table on the EU side. But the difficulty is, I don't think there are the votes for that issue in the House of Commons.
You don't have the votes. I'm going to be using that GIF quite a lot.
Because Jeremy obviously is a Eurosceptic of long vintage. There's a large bulk of Labour MPs who are intellectually pro-European, but they spend 2 minutes in their constituency and they're just like, so about this Brexit I hear so much about. I hear the kids are into that now. The politics of it are quite difficult. But yet again, what is the interest, right? Like they have basically a notional majority for approving spending. Oh, this is great. Approving spending and passing their Queen's speech. For everything else, the DUP are going to go, what have you done for me lately, right? Because of the beauty of the Fixed Term Parliament Act, meaning that government can't just go, we've lost, you've let Corbyn in, which will be unacceptable to a large chunk of the DUP's voters in Northern Ireland. The DUP have a massive amount of leverage. And I think a lot of London Conservatives see these traditional Conservatives with, in my view, a variety of abhorrent socially conservative views, and they assume that they're sort of like straw-chewing hicks. And it's like, no, these people understand negotiation and leverage, I mean, as you'd expect, a great deal more than...
Let's pause on the DUP for a bit, because I think it's really... it's something that actually even pretty well-informed politics advisors hadn't got to grips with. I think we've been very lucky to have... Shout out to notorious PMG, Patrick Maguire, who's been our Tony Howard scholar, who's written consistently on that. And, you know, he wrote a very good article about, you know, all the projections, even YouGov's seat projection, which was vindicated, kind of saying, oh, plus 18 seats in Northern Ireland, saying, well, actually, who gets those seats is kind of quite... important.
I think the YouGov prediction was, I mean, obviously, you know, props to YouGov, who performed incredibly well because they even got the variation. And we were able to, through YouGov's model, be like, oh, no, but we would expect this. It was, yeah, so they had a great election.
And they called some really cuckoo results, like Canterbury, which just...
So I'm going to have a very tiny but, which, yeah, isn't... If you predict a hung parliament, you really then can't go, oh, and who knows who these 18 Northern Ireland MPs will be, because... That is basically going, that becomes, as we've seen, so integral to the results.
Because Sinn Féin abstentions become really vital to work out what a working majority is. And then, you know, like you say, Lady Sylvia Herman's existence has become entirely germane to the running of the British government. But I still think a lot of people don't kind of really know about how their position, because their social and their economic positions are both in the conservative space, but both quite different, right? To mainstream conservatives in England, Wales and Scotland.
The best way to understand them is to think of them as a traditional Christian conservative party in the kind of pre-Thatcher mould. And also one with an electorate that is much more poorer. It looks a lot more like, you know, kind of, you know how like if you want, I was about to say when you watch an old election, and I remember that no one in this conversation but me does that. But when you watch an old election, you go, oh, blimey, look at old elections now. Look at the kind of, you know, the Tory vote coming out of, you know, that bit of Glasgow. That unionist, not very affluent vote that has abandoned the Conservatives' in Britain is still very strong in Northern Ireland. So it's partly, of course, what is the self-interest of their vote. So much more generous on welfare, your kind of social contracty stuff.
I think
of
it's course, money, isn't it? Because, I mean, if you look at almost all the economic and social indicators for Northern Ireland, you know, it's less productive, lower life expectancy, lower average wages. You know, it is not, it is a region that benefits from redistribution and will be very, very keen on more of it.
In the last, yeah, in the era of Ed, they would have perfectly happily done a deal with Miliband. They wouldn't have agreed with them on a variety of issues. But one of their difficulties is Corbyn does reduce their leverage slightly because...
Well, yeah, let's also talk about what they want in terms of social issues. Ruth Davidson brought it up. Now, whether you say that's, I think it's probably both a principled moral stand and also a very useful bit of differentiation for the Scottish Conservative to say, hey, by the way, we're socially liberal, just to, in case anyone's wondering. You know, her phoning up Theresa May to kind of essentially get an assurance that they weren't going to bring in some incredibly, you know, repressive piece of LGBT legislation. But also, Northern Ireland is exempt from the 1987 Abortion Act, right? You have prosecutions of people pending for buying morning after pills on the internet. How much of that agenda is, you know, Owen Paterson was on the radio at the weekend sort of suggesting there would have to be maybe a debate about abortion limits again. And one of the things I find slightly alarming is that a lot of senior Conservatives still in the cabinet are personally in favour of lower limits. So Jeremy Hunt, I think, was in favour of 12 weeks, which is an incredibly low limit.
One of the sort of unreported...
Will it actually come up?
Yes and no. One of the unreported, well, not unreported, because obviously you've written some stuff on it. There's the My Pledge, Her Choice campaign, which has been calling on candidates to sign up to it, and I understand will still be going on even though the election is over. There has been a striking rise in the number of anti-choice Conservative MPs and candidates in the last 15 years or so. There's still that quite strong cross-party alliance of sort of Sarah Wollaston, Liz Kendall, Yvette Cooper, and oh, Jo Swinson, who's now back in the Commons, of course, but who pre-2015 wrecked an attempt to reduce...
Oh, Fiona Bruce's bill. Yeah.
But that force in the Conservative Party is getting stronger anyway. So my instinct is, if this Parliament does go the full 5 years, at some point, in order to pass a timetable motion, the Conservative leadership will have to agree for to have a debate on lowering the abortion ban.
Or they'll sneak, because what Fiona Bruce did, I think, is she put it in under the one of the crime bills as prosecuting sex selective abortions, right?
Yeah.
And that's one of the ways that you kind of just begin to ratchet a little bit away.
Yeah, so what the anti-abortion people are doing, as you know better than I, obviously, is kind of like, look, I'm pro-choice, but...
But, well, this is exactly what the American anti-abortion movement has done, is just going like, rather than attacking the principle itself and trying to overturn Roe v. Wade deliberately, they've said, oh, but you must have a mandatory ultrasound. Oh, but you must have a wand stuck up your vagina and see the heartbeat, you know, before you're allowed to do it. Oh, you know, only such and such clinics that are 50 miles away can get licensed, you know, or, you know, parental, you have to, you know, parents have to be told if you're going to get the morning after pill, all of that stuff, just making it just relentlessly harder and harder and harder and harder. And actually, some of those protests, the kind of, ones that you see, you know, this kind of shouty people outside clinics intimidating people as they go in with pictures of kind of fetuses in jars, has already come here.
Yeah.
It's like you say, there is that cross-party alliance, but I also think it's going to become very tempting to sneak in some of that stuff.
The other interesting pressure point on that issue is Leo Varadkar, the incoming Prime Minister in the Republic. He's economically liberal and socially liberal as well.
But he's moved enormously,
right? They've never debated a PM like him before.
But he's moved, hasn't he? Because he was, a couple of years ago, at no abortion, even in cases of rape. And yeah, now they've had this
And now
big
he's
debate.
Saying that they're going to have a referendum on repealing the Eighth Amendment. Now, the interesting thing is that one of the DUP's aims, for obvious, no one ever wants their voters to get significantly poorer and have a worse time, is for a frictionless border between the north and the south of the Isle of Ireland. Now, my strong expectation is that, although there will be strong pressures, a referendum to repeal the Eighth would succeed. If you then have a situation where people can just walk across to procure an abortion, that then massively accelerates the issue of people being prosecuted for procuring morning after pills on the internet. If people can literally walk 5 minutes, take a morning after pill and come back, what happens then? Do you then start having... You can't have checks at the border for obvious reason. No one wants that. But to be honest, I would be more worried about the future of free access to reproductive rights in this country had the Conservatives won a large majority than I am with them having this deal with the DUP.
Yeah, there's two countervailing tensions. One is the need to give the DUP things in order to have their support. The second is, why would you put through unnecessarily incredibly potent and divisive legislation in a parliament which is hanging by a thread, right?
I don't like going, but this essential issue of basic human rights has a great political upside for the Labour Party. One of the things Theresa May's campaign absolutely succeeded in doing was creating cultural touchstones for anti-conservatism. Saboteurs, Citizens of Nowhere. Citizens of Nowhere, I think, in terms of the places where they lost and lost very badly.
Look at the BME vote. I think Lucy Powell tweeted about this, you know, and actually there was a great blog, I think, that I've tweeted as well, is that more diverse communities were far more skewed Labour, and the turnout was up in those
and
places.
And also, if you notice, say, kind of places like Gloucester, which moved away from Labour in 2015, why? Because you had a very affluent but racially diverse electorate, which in 2010, the affluent ethnic minority vote went, okay, I like the sound of these tax cuts, but I think you don't like me, so I'm going to stick with Labour. Cameron spent 5 years wooing those voters, being very attentive to people's concerns. He very cleverly managed to somehow insulate himself from the go-home vans. I still don't quite understand how he pulled it off, but he clearly did. So for a variety of reasons, in Welwyn, in Gloucester, in outer London, Harrow, you had that affluent ethnic minority vote went, I think I can trust the Conservatives. I myself encountered it on the doors in Cardiff North. You know, guy, big drive, you know, 2 BMW, said, yeah, I voted Labour all my life because I just don't, but I trust the Tories now. I wasn't able to get back to Cardiff North.
Was this an ethnic minority guy?
Yeah, back to Cardiff North this election. But I suspect, partly just looking at the result, that if I had, he would have said what I heard from a lot of other affluent ethnic minorities, which is, she thinks I'm a citizen of nowhere. And that also upset liberals in general, regardless of their ethnicity. But it particularly punched that Tory bruise. You know, one Conservative MP said to me, you know, it's like the second affair. You know, you say you've changed and they believe you and they come back. You do it again and they're furious and they aren't coming back afterwards.
Yeah, which is, again, I think fox hunting again speaks to that. It's a completely random interjection that was seen at the time as this sort of like, oh, she needs to shore up the kind of Tory right. And actually a lot of people heard, we haven't changed.
Yeah, and if you throw onto that opposition to a woman's right to choose, which is hugely popular in this country, you're once again sending a message to people who are comfortably off. They are socially, they might not self-describe as socially liberal, but if you look at how they respond to a variety of attitude questions, they're liberal.
You know, the fact that gay rights are now not seen as a kind of avant-garde edge of social liberalism, right? That it is absolute. You get incredibly staunch right-wingers who are in either civil partnerships or in same-sex marriages, right? It's just that issue is just coming completely not a left-right split anymore at all.
But we did see in this election how it doesn't take very much for the smell to start emanating from the Tory party again, because people have those suspicions. There is, I think, a real risk to them that the kind of social conservatism thing comes up and people remember stuff like the, you know, the war on single mothers, the kind of race memory. Yeah, because the thing is, legislation can be repealed, policies can be undone, but culture does sort of endure.
And also, I think the fact that whether or not, I think it looks like 18 to 24 turnout and the big kind of overexcitement about that might have been overstated, but it does look like under 45 turnout, particularly like as a group, was up. And that's a group that doesn't read newspapers as much as the 45 plus. It's a group that's much more tech savvy, group that's much more socially liberal, much more educated. And all of those things, if that part of the electorate is going to turn out for elections more and more in future, it's possible they turned out this time, they turned out for the EU referendum, then that just changes the calculation of where the middle ground in British politics is. And it's firmly not with the DUP.
In terms of the turnout question, which obviously, you know, in my big piece on the polls before the election, I went, well, look, it basically depends what you think is going to happen.
So I really suspected that turnout might be really low from people being tired of voting. But actually, it's gone the other way. And so it is an election in which people... Some people felt genuinely enthused. I think some people felt that they had something to vote for the first time in a long time. They were really excited to do that vote. And other people really felt, you know, on the other side, the sort of very pro-Brexit vote, really felt that they had to vote this way to kind of guarantee that the thing that they wanted was going to happen.
The big data point that we ought to have paid more attention to was Scotland after its referendum and Northern Ireland's snap election, where, again, a record-breaking turnout. And then, of course, the fact that in 2010, Nick Clegg did get a turnout boost. Now, yes, politically, Clegg and Corbyn are very different, but they are both
they're both energising the
hope,
same group of
you know,
voters.
You know, a break from the usual way of doing things. so all of which I think means we should have been, I can never get my animals right, either more bearish or bullish on the
bullish. Bullish is bullish. Good and aggressive. Bears apparently are sad. Think of like sad Paddington. That's how I think of bearish.
Okay, right. So we should have been more bullish on the turnout issue. My instinct, I mean, it may fade, but there is a real fear in parts of the Tory party of Corbyn, of what he's tapped into, of what he would do if in another election. So I think the thing that the 70s does show us,
I think
the fear
really,
that the electorate will whack you when you meet them does hold a party together like nothing else.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I'm trying to work out whether or not there'll be a second election is... It's difficult for that reasons. I also think there is this problem about, I mean, you can foresee a situation in which, given that, you know, they made huge strides this time, they'd have to make even huger strides for next time. Labour could lose again if there was another snap election. What would then happen, I think, is fascinating, right?
But they have to make a huge strides to govern alone, right? Which, if you are a democratic socialist, then actually, weirdly, the metric for what Corbyn needs to do to succeed in terms of getting that agenda through is a lot larger than if you are a social democrat, because the metric for Corbyn to get in charge and do lots of progressive, social democratic, core redistributive things is a lot lower, right? If they were to gain 30 more, to be honest, if they were gain, provided I'm ignoring gains in Scotland for this purposes, obviously, because gains from the SNP kind of
neutralize each other, and
but basically if they had even half as good a night as they had in England and Wales next time, then they would be quite comfortable in a minority government.
Well, as long as you assume that then the SNP don't decide to be obstructionist for the sake of it, which is a big assumption to make, I guess.
I don't see how the SNP would not find a minority Labour government incredibly difficult to say no to, because... What's their narrative? It's no longer Westminster stops you having a left-wing government. It's we the SNP are
stopping. We'd rather you be governed by the Conservatives, but we get to be pure. Yeah,
yeah, I think that's quite a painful position for them to be in. So actually, the metric for success in terms of the politics I would like to see in, as you know, as someone who's into PR and therefore has basically accepted that you end up with governments of the centre and centre-left, because you have to get to 50% of the vote plus one somehow. The metric for success for Corbyn at the next election is not only low, but very achievable. If you want a kind of more radical left-wing option, then, you know, Tony Benn was absolutely right to oppose PR if that's the type of politics you want. And that is a much bigger adventure for Labour.
Stephen, I'm going to say something in the privacy of the podcast, which I think is probably needs saying, is that most people who voted for Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party don't want a radical left-wing programme. The manifesto he put forward...
No, they want the ameliorative social democratic stuff that was in the manifesto, yeah.
Having talked to people in the PLP, there wasn't a lot they found hard to defend in that manifesto, right? There weren't things... You know, they compromised on Trident.
Some people were nervous about the tax rise, but that's...
I think there was nervousness about whether or not economically it stacked up, but it was... It did at least soothe everybody from the Ed Miliband era, when the feeling was very much like... We'd like to be nice, but the electorate won't wear it. Actually, it's quite easy to defend. We are going to be really nice. Everything will be nice for everyone. Like, it's just, that's quite an easy manifesto to go out and sell if you're, you know, and one thing that Theresa May spectacularly failed to do was land her economic argument that there wasn't the money available to do any of this stuff.
Yeah. So I think it was probably a bit of both, because that's the ultimate cop-out conclusion. But one, Labour were just much more candid about where the tax rises were going to come from in this election. In 2015, we all knew they were going to have some, but the Eds looked very shifty, which meant everyone went, oh, is it me? But the second is, the Conservatives did not have anywhere near the success with any of Labour's tax rises than they had with the mansion tax. They kind of were like, oh, income, oh, tax bombshell, oh, garden tax? I mean, I have no idea what... The garden tax...
Was that something about windows? I can't... No.
I'm
thinking of, like, the 1700s when everybody had to...
It was basically like they were like, it's going wrong, what succeeded in the past? And they were like, insert word here, tax!
Yeah, death tax. And then, unfortunately, the one that actually people remember is dementia tax, which was there. So well done, lads. Top work on that. Well, look, we're going to come back for a regular podcast later in the week where, well, who knows, we might have to talk about the fact there's another election. Let's hope not. But otherwise, we'll be talking about lessons from Labour's campaign. But for now, that is it from us.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Helen Lewis. It's produced by India Balk. Our music is by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. If you haven't, do like the New Statesman on Facebook to get all of our exciting content direct to you. Follow us on Twitter.
And send Stephen a tweet saying which song you'd like him to sing the credits to next time, because we had excellent feedback on that.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.